I woke up this morning with my mind stayed on freedom. I woke up this morning.
Welcome to St. Louis Public Radio's Cut and Paste Arts and Culture Podcast. I'm Nancy Fowler.
And I'm Willis Ryder Arnold.
Today we're talking with poet Treasure Shields Redmond, who weaves together politics with her poetry.
She reads from her latest book called Chopped, a collection of Kwansabas for Fannie Lou Hamer. She was an activist from Mississippi and an early civil rights leader.
This first one is one I believe that her mother would have written on her heart when she had her 20th child, and it's called October 16th, 1917, Montgomery County, Mississippi. Boss, say I birthed 20 field hands, then give to me $50 for Fanny. Done promise this last one to God. Dream I give her to the priest. Took her behind the holy of holies. Came out full grown and singing glory. Shook me woke. Knowed I been changed. I know I been changed. I know I've been changed. You know the angels in a heaven done sign my name. I usually sing after a lot of the poems because that's what Fannie Lou Hamer would do. She, her form of activism involved her spirituality and the emboldening effects of freedom songs and spirituals.
It's an amazing thing to hear you actually kind of perform the piece, too, because when you're reading it, it's short, it's succinct, it's in this, I guess, very spoken language.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
then when you actually read it and you get that intonation and you do the song as well, it mm-hmm. becomes totally filled.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you, thank you. Yeah, the short little form is called a Kwansaba, and it's an American form, 7 lines long. 7 words across on each line, and each word should be no longer than 7 letters unless it is a proper noun. And it's a form that was created by my father, whose name is Eugene B. Redmond. He's been the poet laureate of East St. Louis, Illinois since 1976.
So if your dad was a poet, we have to ask, how did you first encounter poetry, or what is one of your first memories of encountering poetry?
You know, I have to say my first memories of encountering poetry would be in church in Meridian, Mississippi, because even though my father is from East St. Louis, Illinois, my home community was Meridian, Mississippi, as he and my mother co-parented. They weren't partnered, but they co-parented. Having to memorize Easter speeches for Easter pageants and programs at Mount Olive Missionary Baptist Church in Meridian, Mississippi would have been some of my first encounters with verse.
You know, you can hear in what you just read and perform, you can hear the, you know, the Baptist hymns,
mm-hmm.
the influence
mm-hmm.
of that language and rhythm. How important was the church as you continued to grow and become a poet?
Well, I think that, you know, the church is a complex cultural institution in the U.S., and then specifically when you break it down by denomination and race. In many ways, the church gave me permission to be an artist. And, you know, a lot of people would, you know, take umbrage with that because they see the church as kind of anti-intellectual, homophobic, anti-woman, and it's all of those things too. But the version in which I was raised, which was a charismatic Baptist church in the Deep South, because it was a small Mississippi town and a provincial place, the church served all these other functions. So the church would have beauty pageants, the church would have debates.
So it was like a community center. It was
exactly.
A source of, yes.
Exactly. And historically, you know, not as much now, but historically, it had to be everything because of segregation. Now, I was born in 71, so I was born during desegregation, but there was de facto segregation in my town. And then, you know, Mississippi has always historically been about 20 years behind in everything. So, you know, but yeah, it gave me permission to be an artist. They, you know, let me write songs and write plays and write pageants and perform and things. So
when did you start doing that in the church?
Well, you know, there's an interesting walk for me because my mother and my father had some similar trajectories, but they kind of veered in different directions at different parts of their lives. So my mother was raised as a Christian, not super church going, but church going in the way that you would be as a child of the 50s when there's nothing else to do but go to church. So, but when she became a woman in her 20s and moved to St. Louis, where she met my father, she became involved in nationalist, black nationalist organizing, and she joined the Nation of Islam. So when I was a young child, before first grade, I was in Nation of Islam. I wore hijab and practiced that version of Islam. And then, for reasons that I'm not quite sure of, she went back to Christianity. So I went back to Christianity. So
about what age would you have been at that time?
Probably around first grade. But I have vivid memories of Islam. That was an interesting melange in my biography there.
I wanted to get you to tell us a couple of your favorite hymns that you remember from childhood.
Well, you know, I love the emboldening hymns that were turned into freedom songs. One of them is, I woke up this morning with my mind stayed on freedom. I woke up this morning with my mind and it was stayed on freedom. Now, the original lyric is Jesus. And there are lots of songs where the creator was subverted. Yes.
So that would be the substitute.
The creator was subverted, or we could say his proxy stepped in, which was freedom, right? Because there's supposed to be freedom in religion. Supposed to be.
Mm-hmm. And at some point you became interested in hip hop, and did that have an influence in your work as well?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, hip hop has definitely and continues to influence me. So when I was in junior high, I went to see a movie called Crush Groove. If you guys have ever heard of this movie, Crush Groove.
I have, yeah.
So it was the biopic of Def Jam recordings. And it was all about Russell Simmons and his brilliant co-founder, Rick Rubin. So it was a biopic. And my mother and I walked to the movie theater because we walked everywhere. We did not own a car. And
Was this here in St. Louis?
This was in Meridian, Mississippi. I saw it and I was just struck. I was just bitten. I mean, I was listening to hip hop like everyone was listening to, you know, hip hop on the radio. But that was when I knew that I was supposed to be an MC in junior high. And I started writing hip hop verse, and I wrote it every day for about 10 years there. And formed a group with a friend of mine whose name was Terrence Davis. And we had a DJ. His name was Arthur Williams, and we called ourselves the Sonic MCs. And we became local celebrities and performed at our own prom. We lived the dream.
That's excellent.
Tell me there's a recording of this somewhere.
I used to have vinyl, but
I want to hear it so much.
It was called The Class of 89.
The Class of 89.
The Class of 89 was the big hit. It was this homage to our classmates.
Do you remember any of it?
I just remember 89 students hit the floor and assumed the position. Other classes on your post on the sideline. And listen, we don't want to hear no back talk. See you step out of line. Never neglect to respect my fellow classmates who the Class of 89.
Yes. All right. Yes. Bravo.
That's right. Give it up for hip hop.
Right. Was there any conflict at all between the kind of like church influence and then the influence of hip hop?
They really meld seamlessly for me. You know, I am lucky in many ways that the version, and I keep saying the version, because, you know, church is different for everyone. It's just like marriage is different for everyone. You talk to someone who's been married, they're like, I'm not doing that BS again. And then you talk to other people and they're just starry-eyed about it. But I was lucky enough to be raised in a version that wasn't hyper-concerned with gay people. It wasn't hyper concerned with women's dress and whether or not we wore lipstick. It seemed a little hyper concerned with virginity, but not to the point of abstinence ceremonies and promises where you marry your dad. No disrespect to anybody else, but a little strange. And luckily, I wasn't also a part of this, like I've read about it, you know, in lots of black literature, people who were told that's that old dirty blues music and you going to hell and all of that stuff. So no. People were into it. And then our verse reflected our environment. So we weren't talking about selling dope or killing people, even though those are songs that are important. We were talking about, you know, graduating high school. So we were kind of a non-threatening hip-hop group.
So when did you first become interested in politics and that became sort of something that you focused on?
Well, I mean, of course, that was always in the house.
Sure.
Because, you know, I lived in the Deep South. My mother was an avid reader and a writer herself. And I remember her telling me things like, now, you know, that that James Baldwin, he can stone write. She loved poetry and loved the great essayists like James Baldwin. And then, of course, my dad was, you know, very Afrocentric in his appearance and in his speech. So the ability to be apolitical, that just wasn't accessible for me. So I was just like politicized from the start. And I remember listening to the revolutionary rap group, Public Enemy. And Chuck D had this lyric about Huey Newton, Eldridge Cleaver, and Bobby Seale. Three very famous founders of the Black Panthers. And he talked about conspiracies. And, oh, that was just a revelation to me. And I remember I went to my mother, who had lived through all of that, and told her, did you know that there was a group called the Black Panthers and there was a government conspiracy to break the back? And she just kind of rolled her eyes and was like, yeah, I think I knew that. I was very enamored with the bravado of male civil rights activists, especially in the Black Power movement.
And you write a lot about women and the importance of women's voices in civil rights movement and current politics and things like that. How do you kind of like bring that in with that influence of like the male bravado?
Well, you know, it's interesting because Black liberation movements and gender did not have a great relationship in the 60s. People were kind of single track, and they thought you put race before gender. So a lot of harmful patriarchal practices were continued, like expecting Black women to kind of be the kind of maids and secretaries mm-hmm. for movements, and also not acknowledging the kind of central roles that they did play. As I grew into becoming a woman, I began to see more and more the intersectional identities that I inhabited as a Black woman, as a Southerner, as a woman from a working poor household, working poor home community, as a mother, as an educator, in many ways as a product of the migration the Black migration, and that my father's family was from Arkansas. I'm from Mississippi, and now I've taken the same trajectory up from Mississippi to St. Louis. So those inhabited and lived realities helped me to see a fuller picture of civil rights activism.
And then I was curious, like, how do you work that attention kind of into your writing? Do you consciously do that? Do you try to give voice to these other voices? Or is this something that's just, like, obviously a concern of yours and so it just manifests naturally?
I think it's a combination of conscious, deliberate deployment of female figures in my work and a natural affinity for women. I have a son and I have a daughter, and the walk for them is different, and my anxiety about their upbringing is different. So I do work to consciously uplift Black people, but there is a laser focus on girls and women. And then in general in the U.S., I think that part of the reason Fannie Lou Hamer hasn't received the due, even though there's a zeitgeist around her, it's an incredible thing. I mean, plays, books, she's shown up in movies. So I feel the tide rolling in for Fannie Lou Hamer. I believe there will be a biopic soon. I think in the U.S., I think part of the reason why she doesn't stand in our historical memory in the same way as a King or a Malcolm is because she was a woman, because she was poor, and because she was unlettered. So she spoke like her constituency spoke. So her constituency was Black sharecroppers, and that's how she spoke. So that, you know, served to relegate her to a different position than a King or a Malcolm.
Is there another work that you could share with us right now?
Most definitely. All right, this one is called Say Her Name for Sandra Bland, and it starts with an epigraph, hunted and penned in an inglorious spot, Claude McKay. Who will take down this pelt, this swinging skin, this deflated covering? Who will take it down? Who will take her down off the pedestal? Who will dry her clay feet? Who will take her down? Who will clean this garment? Who will take it down from the hanger? Who will lay it out for dressing? Who will climb this rope? Who will move the bottom of their body first, the top of their body next, their hands pulling at once down? Who will pull their clothes off at the end of the day, pulling their skirt down over hips? Who will pull down the soup? Who will prepare the soup? Who will pull down the berries from the trellis, sweet and black? Who will pull down the flavor from a broth? Who will pull down the juice from taut skin? Who will pull down this woman, this cook, this expert at tincture? Who will pull down this woman? Who will pull down this structure? Who will make this place? Who will pull down the character from the line? Who will pull down the highway toward an end? Who will pull down the window for a question? Who will answer a question with a question? Who will pull for subservience? Who will demand an answer they have heard before? Who will pull down anger from the throat? Who will pull this woman from her car? Who will pull a story out of their ass? Who will pull this iron gate shut? Who will pull this report from the file? Who will pull the blood through the embalmer's needle? Who will pull these women from the stone? Who will pull this anointing from these hands? Who will pull the truth from this empty shroud? Who will pull these women down? Who will pull this empty skin hanging down?
Well, we recently had the first anniversary of her death. Is
mm-hmm.
that right?
Yes.
Did you write this, like, about the time that it happened a year ago?
Or? I wrote it about the time that it happened a year ago.
Okay. Mm-hmm. You know, she's one person, and yet she represents, I guess, a lot more than that.
I mean, you know, we can't, it just hangs so resonant, the events of the last few weeks, and racialized gun violence, racialized violence, some of which has been filmed. So a lot of us have been re-traumatized by the images of people's murder, of people running after people with guns, of people dying from gun wounds, of people being held down and shot. And we are definitely in a time in the U.S., a crucible, a time of trial. And what we do next can determine the sort of world that we leave for the people that we love who are coming after us.
How do you see poetry playing a role in that?
Well, I think poets, in the classical sense, like if we think of the Western canon and we think of Plato and Aristotle, what they named poets, just public writers, intellectuals, everyone who wrote was a poet, right? And the poets traditionally were dissident, and well, we know what happened to Plato, right? Had to drink some poison and die for the thing, for his heretical verse there. So I think the poets, in some ways, is sacrificial, because one of the gifts of poetry, being a poet, is being extremely observant. So that far sight allows you to see things sometimes before they happen, or before other people who have to spend so much more time on labor are able to perceive that they're happening, on a different type of labor. So oftentimes poets are punished for that, and then later people go, well, wasn't that person brilliant? It's a burden and a blessing.
You were just listening to poet Treasure Shields Redman. She was discussing her work and why it matters, especially in today's social justice environment. This is St. Louis Public Radio's Arts and Culture podcast, Cut and Paste, produced by Nancy Fowler
and Willis Ryder Arnold. The music you heard at the beginning is by local musician Eric Hall.
You can find Cut and Paste on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.